Now, as you'll see from what I give in the lecture, some of it is quite similar to what I said in the earlier lectures. In fact, all my four lectures are really the same lecture. I remember once, you know, I'll tell you a story. My greatest teacher at UCLA was Walter Starkey, who was he was a professor at UCLA, he was a very old man then. He had been at Trinity College Dublin, and he was a teacher of Samuel Beckett, the playwright. So I remember once he started a lecture, and a student put up his hand. He said, "You're giving the same lecture as last time." And Dr. Starkey said, "Well, it's not exactly the same." And he said, the student made the mistake of saying, "Yes, it's exactly the same lecture." So Dr. Starkey said, "That's the trouble with you Americans. You never want to hear the same thing twice." All right, now, one thing Mises does is he makes a very strong contrast between praxeology, the science of human action, and history. What we have in praxeology is we're giving general laws about the nature of action, whereas history deals with particular events. So you might think, well, even if there is this contrast, couldn't you have some kind of intermediate science between praxeology, which is dealing with the general laws, and history, which is dealing with the particular events? Could we have some discipline that try to establish generalizations about particular events? They wouldn't be general laws of human action, but they would be historical laws. They would deal with laws, say, of particular phases of history or particular phenomena in history. And Mises doesn't think that's possible. He said there aren't inductive generalizations, that's to say, generalizations that are based on testing hypotheses by experience or by experiment that we have in the social sciences, including history. He said dealing with history, there are just so many particulars, there's so many different things happening, so many variables that we couldn't come up with useful generalizations about them, so we just have praxeology in history. Now, what Mises says, and this is, you'll be familiar with this from previous lectures, is that the study of human action is a formal discipline. By that he means we're dealing not with particular actions like my lecturing or my attempting to lecture without my slides or other particular actions, but we're dealing with action as such. We're saying what's involved in any action, what are the features that an action has just in virtue of its being an action. And in the view that Mises has, human behavior doesn't make sense unless we use certain categories. And if we didn't use these categories or these concepts, we wouldn't be able to understand what was going on. Suppose we didn't have the concept, say, of preference, or we wouldn't be able to understand people's actions. We might see them going through doing certain kinds of things, but we wouldn't understand that what they were doing was acting unless we had the concept of preference. So the concepts that we need to understand action, he calls a priori concepts. And by a priori means that there we have to have them before we can understand experience. So they're a priori in the sense we need to have these concepts in order to understand action. I should have said action rather than experience, but as I explained just before, I am senile. I'm not sure how much of a joke that is. Now, one mistake sometimes many people make when they talk about the a priori is that they confuse this with something that's innate, that to say something that is just built into us, say by evolution or by whatever process has gotten us here. So people will say, well, when they're talking about, they'll contrast things we learn just from experiencing the world with things that are built into us biologically. But this is not what what Mises means when he's talking about a priori concepts. Now, I have a quotation here from Mises that I think is very important. He says, the problem of whether there are or may be a priori elements of thought must not be confused with the genetic problem of how man acquired his characteristically human mental ability. This is from Epistemological Problems of Economics. Here, what the important point to realize is that when we say either a concept or a statement is a priori, such as that 2 + 2 = 4, what's meant is that one can grasp this, especially this a priori statement, we can grasp it to be true independently of testing it in experience. Or an a priori concept is one that we have before experience or experience of a certain kind. So it isn't a question of how we came to acquire the concept or what, but rather can we use the concept in grasping some proposition that we see to be true without testing an experience. And in fact, say we have certain concepts that are built into us that are innate, that would raise a difficulty because we might think, maybe we have to see the world in a certain way, we have to grasp the world in a certain way just because biology is built into our brains a certain way of looking at things. But then we could ask, well, why should we think that that way of looking at things, this way that has been built into us by biology, why does that give us reason to think that that gives us any truth? Maybe this, say, we've been built to use certain concepts because this aids our survival, but why should we think that the fact that if it is a fact that we were conditioned to think in a certain way, why should we think that that gives us a reason to think that this is a means of gaining truth? We'd find if we take this innatist view seriously, we might have grounds for skepticism. So the point about a priori knowledge is not that we've been built to see the world in this way, but rather that we grasp that certain categories or concepts are necessary conditions for truth, that we grasp that we couldn't understand action without these concepts, not that we're conditioned to believe that these concepts are that we're conditioned to just to use these concepts by some sort of biological process. Now, there's a passage that I have here that quoted from the Epistemological Problems that might give, if you read this by itself, you might get a misleading idea of Mises' position on this question. I find sometimes when people are reading a text, they'll take a certain statement and just take that and quote it, and they don't look at the context in which it's written. So you can have cases where people say someone says such and such a thing, and in fact, this is the position that the author is trying to refute, but then the person will say, oh, well, look, on this page he says that, and they're ignoring that, the context which it occurs. And we have here exactly a case of this kind. See, Mises says, reason, history, and logic are historical phenomena. Human logic is a historical phase between pre-human non-logic on the one hand and superhuman logic on the other. So if you read this just by itself, you would think, well, Mises is in really some sort of relativist because he's saying, well, sure, we have to use certain logic, we have to use certain categories, but maybe this is just something that is true at the present stage of human development. Maybe there was some pre-human stage where we didn't use that logic. Maybe it'll be some superhuman stage where we'll use a different logic. So if you just took this by itself, you would think that Mises was some sort of a relativist. So if you took it that way, you might wonder, well, how can I be saying, no, he's not talking about the ways we've been conditioned by evolution to think. He said these are necessary presuppositions about thought. Wouldn't I have been misrepresenting his thought? Because he's saying here, he appears to be saying quite the opposite of what I'm saying. He's taking some sort of position just quite different from the one I attributed to him. So you might think, well, even more evidence if it were needed of my senility. But if you look at the passage, you'll see that this is not Mises' own position. In fact, he's saying this is how an empiricist would have to view logic. An empiricist, that's to say someone who didn't think that there were necessary a priori categories of thought, would have to view logic as really not something absolute, but would be just something people at a particular time use. So I think what he's really suggesting is that an empiricist wouldn't be able to account for the notion of that certain categories are necessary for intelligibility, that we can't understand thought without them. He's thinking that an empiricist can say only people use some categories at a particular time. So then the question would come up, if Mises thinks these categories are really necessary for intelligibility, why does he make a separation at all between the categories and reality? Why does he say, well, these are the categories we use to understand reality? Why doesn't he just say these categories are in part constitutive of reality? This is a point that came up in Roderick Long's lecture, which gave earlier this morning. And I think one reason Mises uses this language is that he has a certain reluctance to make absolute claims. Rather than say, this is the only possible logic, he just said, well, we really can't say anything about other possible logics. He's reluctant. This is characteristics, I think, of some people in the Kantian and neo-Kantian tradition. There is some reluctance to say this is just a necessary category for intelligibility, constitutive of the world. They actually come close to believing that, but they're holding back a little. They just want to leave a little room for doubt. So I think when they don't, Mises isn't intending to suggest that they're, the categories are just some kind of mental frameworking that we impose on reality. He's just a bit reluctant to assert the full claim that I think, in fact, his position commits him to. Now, one thing I've been a bit careless about so far is I haven't really distinguished adequately between a priori concepts and a priori propositions. Now, usually when in praxeology, although Mises very often will talk about a priori concepts, what he has in mind is a priori propositions. For example, suppose we say action aims to reduce felt uneasiness. That isn't always true, I should say, because I could reduce my felt uneasiness by stopping lecturing, but I'm not going to do that. That was another joke, but you people aren't laughing. No wonder there was only one person who got 20 out of 20 on the exam. Okay, so what is the distinction between the concepts and propositions? Well, a concept is an idea I have of something. It's something we can think about, say the concept of an incoherent lecture would be one example of a concept. But a proposition is an assertion. It's the verbal expression of a judgment. So I'm saying something about something. I'm predicating. I'm making a predication. I'm saying, suppose I say action involves the use of means to achieve ends. That's a judgment. Its verbal expression is a proposition. So you see the distinction. A proposition consists of concept, but the distinction is a concept is the idea, is an idea, and a proposition is the expression of a judgment. Now, what do we mean when we say a proposition is a priori true? This is one you frequently find in asserted by Austrian economists, but it's very important to be clear exactly what it means. A priori proposition is one that can be known to be true independent of experience. Now, you notice the emphasis there is on can. It's possible to know the proposition independent of experience. For example, suppose we take 2 plus 2 equals 4, which I assume, assuming we're in a non-Molyneux world, is true. So here we don't have to say as soon as we understand the proposition 2 plus 2 equals 4, we grasp right away that it's true. We don't need to keep testing it. Say, well, here we've got two objects and two other objects. Does it add up to be 4 this time? So everything's all right. We can assume our hypothesis has been verified. Then we'll go on and test it another time. So that isn't how we do it. We can just grasp right away as soon as we understand it that it's true. You can come to know a proposition that is in fact a priori, one you could understand, grasp to be true without testing it, without experience in some other way. For example, suppose you had some complicated mathematical theorem and you find it, you don't really get the proof for it, but your math teacher whom you have a justified true belief plus various other conditions tells you that it's true, so you might, under suitable conditions, know that the theorem is true, even though you don't grasp it yourself without experience, without testing and experience. You just know, you know it's true in some other way. So when you say something is a priori true, it means you can understand it. You can know it to be true without further testing. And this actually raises, there are all sorts of complicated problems this raises, such as, is the notion of a priori truth relative to different people, and that, say, one person would be able to grasp something as true without testing it, without testing, where somebody else couldn't, or should we use some concept of the a priori that doesn't make reference to particular people? That's one of the disputed issues. One other very important confusion to avoid is when you say that a proposition is a priori true, you aren't making any claim about how the concepts in it are acquired. Suppose, for example, someone thinks that our concepts of numbers, they're acquired by abstraction from the empirical world. We don't have an a priori concept of numbers. We just acquire the concepts by some sort of empirical process. Someone could hold that theory. I'm not going into now whether that's a good theory of how we get concepts of numbers or not, but someone could hold such a view and still think that 2 plus 2 equals 4 is an a priori truth, because what's involved in a priori truth is how we can know the proposition to be true, not how we know how we get the concepts that are used in the proposition. So suppose, give an example here. Suppose we take the proposition, nothing can be red and green all over its surface at the same time. So if this is an a priori true proposition, then we can grasp that it's true right away. We don't need to test it out. We don't need to paint a surface red and try to paint it all red and green and see what happens. Probably get a lot of paint on our hands. But you could hold that. Suppose you say, well, you think that is an a priori true proposition. You could still hold that color concepts are acquired through experience. You could have an empiricist view of how concepts are acquired and still believe in a priori truth. A lot of people, the fact that people think this leads to trouble for Austrian economics, and it's one reason that Austrian economics is a minority position among economists when they're talking about methodology. A lot of people are very suspicious of a priori knowledge. The idea doesn't make sense to them, because the objection is something like this. Well, how can we learn something about the world just by thinking about things? In order to learn about the world, we have to go out in the world and test our hypothesis. We have to rely on our senses. We can't just sit in an armchair and just think about things. That's considered a kind of an outdated way of doing things. There's a picture of the history of science, which I don't think is a very good one, that said, well, in the Middle Ages, and people just relied on Aristotle and other ancients as authorities, and they just tried to comment on what those people were saying. But The scientific revolution began. People were actually going out and testing hypotheses, and it's only since people did that that we really acquired a great deal of knowledge. As I say, I don't think that's a very good picture of the history of science. In fact, Aristotle himself was a great experimentalist, a great in biology, and a great observer. He wasn't just someone who sat and thought about things, and people in the Middle Ages did experiments. But that's a commonly held picture of things. So people say, well, how can there be a priori knowledge? To get knowledge about the world, we have to go out and test things. Now, one response to this by proponents of a priori knowledge is kind of a concessive answer. They'll say, a priori knowledge doesn't, in fact, give us new knowledge. It's just spelling out the implications of what we already know. Say, suppose we have 2 + 2 = 4. People hold this view would say, well, we're not learning something new when we say 2 + 2 = 4. We're just making explicit what's involved in the meaning of 2 and 4 and adding 2 + 2 = 4. So in this view, a priori truths are just what's called analytic propositions or tautologies. That's to say, they're definitions or parts of definitions or just instances of logical formulas that are guaranteed to be true, but they're not giving us any new knowledge of things. They're just really rephrasing what's already there in the term. So then the people would say the way a priori knowledge is possible is that it's just really, in a sense, telling us what's there already. It isn't claiming that we can know anything new. Now, the contrasting response is that, in fact, a priori knowledge can give us new information about the world. This would be a view that at least some a priori propositions are a synthetic a priori. Synthetic would mean non-analytic. That's to say, they're not just definitions or parts of definitions or instances of logical formula. They're giving us genuine information about the world, but we can know that they're true independent of experience. So those are two views of a priori knowledge. Now, question would come up, well, which one did Mises accept? Now, a lot of people think that Mises accepted the view that the propositions of economics were synthetic a priori truths. But if you look at human action, which I hope you do, at least if you want to pass the oral exam, you'll find that Mises never uses that term for any of the deductions he makes, any of the theorems of praxeology. He never calls them synthetic a priori truths. He doesn't say they're not, but he doesn't use that term. In his last theoretical book, Ultimate Foundation of Economic Science, he seems more sympathetic to synthetic a priori truths, but he doesn't commit himself to accepting them in economics there either. He uses in that book, he uses what I think is a very interesting argument against those who reject synthetic a priori truths. He says, supposing somebody claims there's no such thing as a synthetic a priori truth. He says, well, that seems to be a synthetic a priori proposition itself. So it's self-undermining, but he doesn't commit himself to saying that there are synthetic a priori truths, much less than there are synthetic a priori truths in economics. Now, in fact, in Human Action, he aligns himself with this, what I call this concessive response to the people who question a priori truth. He says that the truths of economics are tautologies. Remember, tautology is really a statement that isn't giving, it's really sort of a statement that in effect says the same thing. It isn't telling you anything new. It's a definition or a part of a definition or an instance of a logical formula. So it isn't giving you any new information. But if Mises says that the propositions of praxeology are tautologies, then the problem comes up, aren't tautologies useless? Now, there's a famous example that Wittgenstein gives where he says, supposing someone asks you, how's the weather? And you say, well, it's either raining or not raining. So what you've said is certainly true. It's just an application of a logical law, but it isn't telling you anything about the weather. It's just applying the logical law. So the objection would be, if Mises says that praxeology consists of tautologies, then isn't he conceding too much? Isn't he really saying that praxeology isn't telling you anything interesting? It's just empty, in the same way someone who said in response to a query about the weather that it's either raining or not raining wouldn't be saying anything interesting or important. And in response to this, Mises suggests that, in fact, some tautologies are very useful to us. They're tautologies in the sense that they're just implications of logical laws, but they do give us information in the sense that they tell us something we weren't aware of. For example, one view of mathematics, I think there are objections to this view, but some people hold this, is that mathematics consists of tautologies. But nevertheless, when we find there are theorems that we certainly don't understand right away, that we could understand only after we see how they follow from complicated proofs. So even if there are tautologies in some logical sense, they in fact convey new information to us. Now, the best defense of this view, which I've called the concessive view, is in a paper by Leland Yeager called Tautologies in Economics and Natural Sciences. I think if you want to understand that what I call this useful tautology view, Yeager's paper is the best place to go. I should say Dr. Yeager is in his late 80s now. I think he's going to be giving he was a professor here for many years at University of Virginia before. He's one of the great characters. I remember last time I saw him, which was at the Austrian Scholars Conference, I said hello to him. I said, how are you feeling? And he said, let's not get into that right now. So, as I said already, this is the useful tautology approach. And I already said the other approach would be to say, well, there's a priori knowledge, but it gives us genuinely true new knowledge. It isn't something, well, maybe it's, we didn't realize it before, but it's really it's really just a tautology, even though it's telling us something that we didn't know because we didn't grasp the full logical implication of the tautology. This other view The synthetic a priori says, no, it's not a tautology. It's a priori, but it gives you new knowledge. And as I said before, Mises in Ultimate Foundation of Economic Science is more sympathetic to that view, but he doesn't commit himself to it there either. Now, one other point about a priori knowledge, remember, a priori proposition is one that you can know independently of experience. You don't require to test, you don't need to test it out in order to know it's true. Now, in order to be an a priori proposition, it isn't required that the proposition be necessary. What do I mean by that? Well, a necessary proposition is one that isn't conceivably false. There's no possible world in which it's false. There's no, imagine a possible world is just something like, say we have the actual world, we imagine the world change in various ways. Let's say we weren't in this room, but there's another possible world where I'm lecturing upstairs. There's another possible world where I'm not lecturing at all. So imagine all the logically conceivable states of affairs. So a necessary proposition is one that's true in all of them. And when we say something is an a priori proposition, that's a statement about how we know something rather than whether the proposition is necessary. Suppose I take the proposition, I now exist. Well, I know this is true. I don't have to test out whether I exist. I grasp it right away. I know it's true. Probably many of you wish it were false, but it isn't one that is not, it is true in all possible worlds. There are many possible worlds where I don't exist. Whether the best possible world is one of them is a question I won't go into. So it's important not to confuse a priori truth with a necessary truth. Now, I want to turn now, after thoroughly confusing the topic of the a priori, to another topic very important in considering the a priorism and the empiricism in social sciences. This is a basic principle that Mises gives called methodological individualism. This is the principle that only individuals act. Supposing we're talking about suppose we say that a nation acts like, say we say, the United States invaded Iraq in 2003. Methodological individualism doesn't rule out such statements, quite the contrary, but it says that statements attributing actions to nations or other collective bodies have to be explained by actions of individuals. So it's only individuals who act. Sometimes this is misunderstood. For example, there was a very important essay by Robert Nozick, the great philosopher who died in 2002, one of the greatest 20th century philosophers, who had a paper called On Austrian Methodology, and he took methodological individualism to be the view not just that only individuals act, but that all social phenomena have to be explained in terms of the actions of just a few individuals. So if you appeal to large groups of individuals who are acting, that would violate methodological individualism. But that isn't the way that Mises and other Austrian economists use the term. So it's just that only individuals act. Now, it's very important to grasp that this view does not entail that collective entities such as nations or classes don't exist. It's just that they can't act independently of individuals. Now, another point, this is one that I didn't cover in previous lectures, so you can't say you've heard it all before. There's at least one sentence that you didn't hear before. I hope more than that. But we shouldn't think methodological individualism as implying that the individual somehow comes before the family or the nation, that in order for families to exist, say, individuals had to exist first, kind of in isolation, then they got together and formed families, and maybe then they got together further and formed nations. That could have been the case, but methodological individualism doesn't imply that. Mises says, and this again is from Epistemological Problems of Economics, this does not mean that the individual is temporally antecedent. It doesn't exclude it, but it doesn't imply it either. So somebody could hold the view, say, that human beings have always existed in families or groups, and that wouldn't contradict methodological individualism. It would just be that if you would just hold that if you wanted to explain what a family was doing, you would have to do so in terms of the actions of the individuals who composed it. You couldn't say, well, the individuals are acting in a certain way, but unfortunately for them, the family decided to do something else. You could certainly have cases where individuals' actions are frustrated and they can't achieve what they want, but the family or other group wouldn't act independently of the individuals. I want to differ here with one of the other lectures on one point. I hope he doesn't hear what I'm saying, because then that would lead to trouble. Guido Holtzmann has argued, at least I don't know if he still holds this view, I think he does, that methodological individualism is not a principle of economics. He doesn't reject methodological individualism, but he says it's just a principle of historical explanation, so it isn't really a principle of economics. And why does he say that? He says that economics is doing is trying to discover invariant causal laws on economic behavior, and you don't need methodological individualism to come up with such laws. I'm not sure whether he's right that you don't need methodological individualism to come up with invariant causal laws, but let's assume that he is right about that. I don't think it would follow from that methodological individualism isn't part of Austrian economics. It would just show that he's using a different definition of economics from the one that Mises used. In Mises' view, we would have all sorts of things that aren't invariant causal laws that are part of economics. For example, suppose you say action involves the use of means to achieve an end. That is a proposition that Mises affirms to be true, but I don't see how it's stating a causal relationship. It's not suggesting that means there's some sort of causal relationship there. It's just an account of the concept of action. So I think here what we have is simply a difference between the definition of economics that Guido and Mises are using. I've said most of the talk I've given has been, the talk is on a priorism and empiricism. Most of the talk has been devoted to a priorism, but I want to say a little bit about empiricism, specifically in the as applied in history. Now, the historian, that's to say the person who is concerned with explaining or particular events, can use the results of praxeology to help explain historical events. For example, supposing you're trying to explain the Great Depression of beginning in October 1929, continuing through the 1930s, well, you can use Austrian business cycle theory, or you can apply praxeology to help you do that. And also, the historian can use the results of particular sciences in trying to explain historical events. And Mises gives an example in Theory and History. He says, well, supposing a historian was trying to explain the witchcraft, there were great, say, in the 16th, 17th century in Europe, there were great outbreaks of persecution of people who were alleged to be witches, and there were all sorts of many of the witches were burned at the stake. You can Hugh Trevor Roper has a very good essay on this called The European Witch Craze. So, but Mises says, well, a historian who is trying to explain that to witchcraft today would not use the view that there really were people in communication with Satan, and that was so there really were witches, and the persecutors of the witches were responding to a real danger, because that view has been overthrown by science. So this would be an example of how, according to Mises, the historian can use the results of particular sciences to explain what's going on in history. Now, if you come to my next lecture, you'll see there's a little addition to this that throws that's kind of a little story about that example. And I won't put that in here as an I'll just leave that as an incentive for you to come to my next lecture so you can find out the rest of this. Now, even though the historian can use praxeology and the other sciences to help explain particular events, this isn't sufficient to understand what's going on in history, because remember, particular events aren't deducible from general laws of praxeology or general laws of the sciences either. And to understand particular events, Mises says the historian has to use what he calls specific understanding, or he sometimes uses the German word Verstehen. So it's there's a special method the historian uses to understand particular events. So the historian can very often list causal factors for particular events, but in order to assess how important these causes are, he has to use a judgment. He has to have a certain way of judging these causal factors that isn't the application of any general laws. He just has to be able to judge what the relevance of these factors, and this requires what Mises calls specific understanding. So what is involved here, as I said, is not something that is subject to exact rules, but the historian has to, what he's doing is, say, when he's dealing with the actions of particular people, like let's say, what would be a case, suppose the historian is saying, why did the British government declare war on Germany September 3rd, 1939, in response to Hitler's invasion of Poland on September 1st. So what the historian would do, according to Mises, would be to try to imagine that he was in the situation of the British policymakers, principally the Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain and the Foreign Secretary Lord Halifax, and he would say, given the beliefs and values of those people and their knowledge available to them, what would they have thought about the situation? The historian would be trying to reconstruct the thoughts of the actors of the time in order to explain what they did. So this kind of understanding, this kind of specific understanding, could be compared in a way with the judgment of an entrepreneur. Say an entrepreneur in business is not someone who applies some sort of general formula, but he's someone who can perceive a certain profit opportunity, has to use a special faculty of judgment. So this is another case where someone is using a special faculty of judgment that's not amenable to general rules. The historian just has to have a facility of being able to, or faculty, I should say, of being able to grasp how particular people in the past thought. Now, Mises holds that in trying to explain historical events, the historian always uses ideal types. And an ideal type, and this again is from Epistemological Problems of Economics, is the representation of complex phenomena of reality, either men or institutions or ideologies. So what's always involving ideal type, even if it's ideal type of an institution or ideology, is a reference to human motivation. So what you're doing in an ideal type is exaggerating certain kinds of human motivations, like supposing, say, you took the ideal type of a businessman as someone who's just someone who's aiming at maximizing money income. So the ideal type of the entrepreneur is always trying to maximize income. So then you would be able to get how someone with that goal would think, what he would do. And using that ideal type would help you explain, say, behavior of actual people in history. Now, an ideal type is, Mises distinguishes from what he calls a class concept. An ideal type doesn't have an exact definition. It just has, it's what's sometimes been called a cluster concept. There are various things you can find in an ideal type. And if you have enough of those, then you have an instance of a type. For example, supposing we're trying to have the ideal type of a revolution. We couldn't say a revolution has exactly such and such a set of criteria. So someone might say, well, the American Revolution wasn't a real revolution, say, because it didn't overthrow the prevailing class structure at the time. And the definition of a revolution is that it has to do that. If we take a revolution to be an ideal type, we couldn't say that. It's just that a revolution has to have some of the various items on the list of qualifications for the ideal type. But a class concept of the kind used in economics would have to have an exact definition. Okay, so I guess if people have a couple questions, like we can finish up. Yes.
Concerning analytical and synthetical truths, what do you think about the critique of Leonard Peikoff in his appendix to the booklet about objectivist epistemology? There he says that the distinction between those two is compelling if we would say that knowledge 1-0 kinds of people, those who understand binary and those who don't. So for some people, that is an analytic proposition. Why? Because they have already acquired the concept of binary thinking. To others, that same proposition is a synthetic proposition. So because they have not integrated binary into the knowledge. So if you know that, is the distinction between analytical proposition and synthetical proposition not purely subjective upon the individual?
No, I wouldn't be inclined to say so, although there are I think there are various arguments, say, given by Quine and others for rejection of the distinction, but I don't think Peikoff's analysis is really acceptable because he's really assuming this is one of the basic tenets of objectivist metaphysics, is he really thinks aside from human choices, everything that exists is really necessary. The actual world is the only possible world. So if we really grasped, if we really had complete understanding, we would see that everything really is necessary. So that would be, I think he's somehow equating the, he equates the necessary with the analytic, which I don't think is right. So he said, well, if we could really grasp things fully, we'd see everything is necessary. It's just, we think that some things are synthetic because, rather than analytic, because we haven't made all the right connections, or what they call integrations. If we really integrated everything correctly, we see that everything except human choices is necessary. So I think unless you accept that metaphysics, then I don't think you'd want to go along with the rest of his thought. Well, I guess we're out of time now, so thanks very much.